Hello and welcome to this episode of Journey to a Dream, brought to you by Kawasaki Insurance. My guest today is one of those people who is integral to road racing on the Isle of Man. Not only does he have a fantastic history himself, but his input into helping others pursue their dream is just phenomenal. And without him and his teammates, the TT and other road racers here on the island just wouldn't be able to go ahead. Let's meet him now.
So my name's Jim Hunter. I'm a travelling marshal. I've been a travelling marshal for 32 years. First year was 1991. I'm also involved in the organisation of the Max Grand Prix races. I'm vice chairman of the Max Motorcycle Club, and I'm a trustee of the Haywood Foundation, and a few other things as well.
Also a bit of a football fan. We'll talk about Wolverhampton later.
Yes, yeah, Wolverhampton Wanderers, of course. Yeah, I can talk about football till the cows come home, definitely, yeah.
Jim, tell me where your interest in motorcycle racing came from. Where did it start?
Okay, yeah, it's quite a long story, but it really begins with my granddad, who was a test rider for BSA motorcycles. He used to come to the Isle of Man every year as part of his job. He had four children, one of which was my mum, but my mum's got three brothers, Billy, Dennis and Alan. Of course, they always wanted to come with my granddad, but they didn't have enough money. My granddad said, if I ever win the pools, we'll all go to the Isle of Man. And he did win the pools. not a huge amount of money, but enough money to take his family on holiday. So they all came over here in the 1950s. And I don't think my mum has missed a year since, apart from the year I was born and my brother was born. So that's quite a record, really. As a youngster, I lived in a town called Newport, Shropshire. And we used to take a drive up the A41 to Liverpool and get on the boat and come over for the TT. And used to stop just over there. I can see it at the moment. Royal Avenue West, Onken. That was our entire childhood, watching the races and going over to White City on the old pleasure park and everything. And of course, if you get so wrapped up in something, it becomes your lifelong ambition to either want to play for Wolves or become a bike racer. I didn't make the football, but I did get to ride on the TT course.
Did you try the football?
I still play football. I know that's hard to believe as a 60-year-old guy, but I still play football with my friends at school on a Friday. We always have a game of five-a-side, and I love playing football. It's a big thing for me. But to get to ride around the mountain course in the Manx Grand Prix, it was everything and more. I don't think I can ever pay back the debt I feel that I have to the event, because it was just such an unbelievable thing to do. If you like riding bikes, as I've always done, to get the chance to ride around the mountain course and they close the roads for you and encourage you to go as fast as you can, it's just like the best thing you could ever have.
Do you remember, Jim, that point where you made the decision that you said, actually, I am going to do that, I am going to race around there?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I could tell you a little story. I graduated in 1985, decided I wanted to become a school teacher. So in 1986, I was doing my postgraduate qualification, but also racing my bikes at the weekend. I got offered a job at Pershore High School in Worcestershire, sort of leading up to the job offer. The interview had gone really well, and they did say to me, if you are offered the job, you're going to have to accept it or decline it at that particular moment in time. So they offered me the job and they said, you're going to accept it. I said, I need the weekend to think about it. And he gave me the weekend to think about it. So I rang him back on Monday and said, look, I'd like to start, but I can't start until September the 10th. He said, why is that? I said, I've got a special holiday booked and I'm not missing it for anything because I've put so much effort into it. The head teacher, Mr. Geacock, Pershore High School, he said, September the 10th. Yeah, that's okay. You can start then. So that was the green light for me to come over and compete in the Manx Grand Prix, which I ended up winning, to make it even better. They had all these crazy headlines in the paper, like Hunter plays truant and breaks all records and mad stuff like that.
That's incredible. Yes. And in terms of getting from doing the racing that presumably you had been doing in the run-up to MGP, I mean, was your journey to that start line a relatively smooth one?
It wasn't particularly long, I don't suppose. I did three or four years club racing. It was a big commitment, and when I say I put everything into it, I did quite literally put every last penny I had into it, because it meant so much to me. It was absolutely something that I felt that I had to do, and I got the chance to do it.
And was your family's reaction to all of this?
I think that they were obviously a little bit apprehensive about it, because they know all about the Isle of Man, they know the dangers of competing on the course, but they gave me their full support, and my dad helped me out with my bike and buying tyres and stuff like that, and you can imagine for them as well, I guess, being lifelong fans of the event. When we came back in afterwards and were in the winner's enclosure, it was quite a family moment. It was a treasured moment. My brother was there, my brother Jeff, he was there as well. So, yeah, it was a great time for us.
And as you say, not only did you win that newcomer's race in 1986, you did set a new lap record along the way as well.
For that particular class, I didn't feel like I had it in me. What happened was I was leading for the first two laps, then I lost the lead. At that point, I thought, right, I'm just going to go for it now, which is what I did. And I went a lot faster than I expected I would.
Do you remember crossing that finish line?
Yeah, I do, yeah. Yeah, I can remember it like it was yesterday. It's pretty scary to think it was so long ago. Having the opportunity to take part, that was the first thing. But I guess getting a decent result is just the icing on the cake.
So September the 10th, you were back to school.
Back to school, yeah.
What did you decide you wanted to do after that? Because not only did you come, you did the newcomers race, you won it. Where do you go from there?
Well, I had the chance of riding in the TT then. So again, Mr. Gcock, Persia High School, knocking on his door. And he was very accommodating. And he said, yeah, that's fine. You can, because I know on the Isle of Man, the school holidays are in line with the TT week, but in the UK, of course, they're not. But he granted me the permission to have a week off, and I came over and rode in the 1987 TT, which, I think I'm right in saying this, ended up being the first TT race that was ever cancelled because of bad weather. So I got to ride in the Formula 2 race, which was a bit of a sort of sideshow for me. I wanted to ride in the production race, which was on the Friday. All the TT fans will tell you that Joey Dunlop won that race in the morning, and Phil Mellor fell off, and the weather was atrocious, and they decided to cancel the race that I was hoping to try and do well in. But there you go. As my dad always said to me, everything happens for the best. That's his saying. So I did do a couple of TTs after that, but 1991 was my last TT.
How did you make that decision?
That's an interesting question. Can I tell you a little story about that?
Yeah.
1991, I'd made an application to join the St Ninians High School. I came over in February and I had looked around the school and thought, yeah, wonderful school, I really like it. And I got on really well with the head of department, a guy called Alex Townsend, who went on to become the computer bus man. I don't know if you've ever met Alex. And I was thinking to myself, oh, it's a two-day interview. I think if I let on that I am interested in the bikes, they're not going to give me the job, because they'll think to themselves, the only reason he wants to come to the island is because he wants to come for the bikes. So I didn't mention it to Alex.
You're just hoping that he hadn't recognised the name.
He used to work for the Department of Tourism, actually, so he's a good friend of Peter Neal's. So I didn't mention the bikes. I went through the whole interview, nothing at all. And then they said to me, well, we'd like to offer you the job. And one of the things we do for people that we appoint is we give them the opportunity to come over and visit the island. When would you like to come? So I said, well, how about the first week in June? And they said, yeah, fantastic. We have this thing on called the TT. It's not going to be... But the irony of it was, it's a little bit naughty. I can tell the story now because I'm retired. I was actually riding in the TT that year. And I sort of mixed in with that my school visit at the same time.
Did you ever mention it at all? Did you just
after I sort of established there, I thought, okay, it's safe to tell the story now. I've just retired. I did 32 years at St Ninians High School. Yeah, wonderful school, great school.
1991 then, you moved over, you started that new position.
That was my last TT. I'm not saying my heart wasn't in it, but I didn't feel like, I don't know if I overthink these things, I didn't really feel like the desire to ride at the speed that you need to ride at, it wasn't there anymore. So I thought, because it's such a competitive thing, if you're not going into it fully committed, you perhaps don't ride as well as you want to, and then you get disappointed with yourself. And then I personally thought, you know, that's it. It's finished for me. So I decided to call it a day then. Then the following year, 1992, that's right, I started playing for Moran Football Club. I was in the Crosby pub and I got to know Ewan Killip, because he also played for Moran, and his dad, Kipper Killip, was chief travelling marshal. We were in the Crosby pub on Christmas Eve and he came and offered me the job of travelling marshal, which I didn't bite his hand off, because I thought, it's a fantastic opportunity to have the bike and everything, but I've always been a little bit squeamish. I famously fainted. I went for an interview at the blood transfusion service before I became a school teacher and passed out on the when I went round the labs. A little bit squeamish, but in my experience, you can't really predict how you're going to react in a particular situation. You might think, I'm going to be able to react in this way, but until you get presented with it, I don't think you can be absolutely sure how it's going to pan out. So I said to Kipper on Christmas Eve, look, I'll have a think about it and I'll tell you. And I thought, well, if I don't give it a go, then I'm always going to regret it. So I'll give it a go and see how it works out. And yeah, it works out fine.
What are the qualifications you need to become a travelling marshal?
It's a little bit different now. Back then, you actually didn't need any qualifications, absolutely nothing, other than people used to say, go in a Crosby and buy a kipper, lots of rum, that rum and coke, that's what he used to drink, yeah. But you were encouraged to do first aid courses, but there was no, you have to have this, you have to have that, you have to have the other. That's changed now. You have to, there's quite a lot of training involved. We do an immediate care course at the hospital. We do technical training, so that in the event that a bike is black flagged and somebody has to make a judgment as to whether or not it's safe for that rider to proceed. So that's our call, and we have to make that decision. We meet on a regular basis. Tony Duncan organises that. Of course, Tony Duncan's the Chief Traffic Marshal. It's a reasonably big commitment, but it's a wonderful thing to be involved in. I really like it.
And so that first outing that you had, what do you remember about that?
What I remember is, really, in that week, there were four quite big incidents. I don't know how it panned out that way, but I got involved in dealing with all of them. And arguably, it depends on where you look at it. I came out of that feeling quite reassured. And on the very first evening, a rider called David Goodley fell off his Kawasaki coming into Glen Helen. I was at the Ballacrane, so I got a call to attend the incident. That went fine. And then another rider called Bob Grant fell off, and then two other riders fell off later on in the week. And I was involved in dealing with all of those incidents. When the incident's finished and you ride away and you think, okay, well, that went okay, that maybe I need to think about that, and quite analytical about how you dealt with the situation. Obviously, you learn a lot as you go along. But overall, I thought, yeah, I think I did okay there. That was all right. So that made me feel a bit more confident about carrying on.
I suppose, Jim, it's one thing dealing with the squeamish side of coping with riders who've fallen off and may have injured themselves. We know, though, that incidents can be much more serious than that. How do you cope with that?
It's obviously if it's a very serious incident, it's a difficult thing to have to come to terms with. And because I've been travelling marshal now for over 30 years, I've obviously dealt with a large number of incidents, and I can pretty much say that I can absolutely remember all of them. I remember the words of Gareth Davies, who's the, I know you know Gareth, and Gareth came into school once, and at the time he came into school, he came in for our awards evening. So we got the whole school in the hall, 1,200 students. And Gareth came in. He used to live opposite the school. And he started to tell these wonderful stories about how he never used to get out of bed until he heard the school bell. He always got there late. Then he started talking to the students, saying things like, look, don't worry so much if you prefer Angus Deaton to William Shakespeare, because that's absolutely okay. Then he started talking about his job, which was very high profile at the time, because he was working for the London Air Ambulance, which was being broadcast on the BBC. And he gave this wonderful talk to the students, over 1,000 people. And he was saying, in my line of work, what you got to remember is that you get used to dealing with very difficult situations, but the way in which you approach the situation and the way you deal with the people involved in it and what you say to people afterwards, they're going to remember that forever. And he was talking about the difference between physical scarring and mental scarring. He said physical scarring, you recover from that over a period of time. But the things that you say to people in the event, if you have to break some really bad news to them whatsoever, they're never, ever going to forget that. That always stuck in my mind as something, especially coming from him, because he's such a cool guy. He's so smart. And when the helicopter lands and Gareth steps out, you think, happy days, everything's going to be okay. I think your own coping mechanism is that you have to accept it for what it is and then decide whether or not, do you want to be involved? You know, I'm reaching the twilight years of my travelling marshal career. People say, do you want to do another year? So I said, yeah, I'd love to do another year. So my current position has been reviewed on an annual basis.
How many travelling marshals are there?
There's seven of us.
And you're presumably very close. And
oh, that's a huge part of it. When my time comes to finally step aside, I'm really, really going to miss that. What's nice is that we still, for example, in our WhatsApp groups, we've got 2024 travelling marshals, and we've got a travelling marshal social WhatsApp group. So when we have a Christmas function or something like that, everybody gets invited. So that's nice that you don't totally drop off the edge. But I will miss it, because the other guys that are a part of that team, and I think Tony's done an absolutely superb job. The team now is probably the strongest it's ever been, because he's got a real nice mix of youth, with Johnny Hagenbotham and Woody, and experience, Tony, myself and Steve Granger, Paul Corrin. And we've also got Darren Slew, who's joined us a couple of years ago. Darren, he's fitted in really, really well. And we've got Richard Wilson. Richard was competing in the TT and the Max Grand Prix last year, but my understanding is he's not competing this year, certainly not for the TT, but he's joined us in the Travelling Marshal team, so we'll have a... I think now, I'm not sure if we're going to have 8 marshals on the course, or 7, plus a reserve, and cycle things round to give people a night off, and I'm not quite sure how that's going to work yet, I don't know.
I think the real essence of the Travelling Marshals is you all, more than anybody, understand why people do what they do on that race course.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Because we're all past competitors. I think that's really important. And you know, some of the, not so much me anymore because I'm so old, but it used to be the case. You used to pull up, still occasionally, you pull up in the paddock and people ask you about the course and people can ask, you know, what's the weather like and you know, have you done a lap and all this sort of business. It's nice that people appreciate what we do. It's a big, big part of my year, and when I'm too old to do it, I'm going to miss it for sure. And let's not forget the Southern 100 as well, and the pre-TT Classic. George Peach and Phil Torman and co down there doing absolutely just such a wonderful job, and that's a really nice thing to be part of.
And you must feel pretty, I mean, I don't want to say cool, because saying cool sounds totally uncool, but there is just something about seeing the Travelling Marshals set off on their own. I mean, is there a limit to what speed you can do? How does that work?
No, there's no speed limit, no, because we're all past competitors. And of course, the other thing that people could be forgiven for not considering, I had one guy on social media saying, "What you know, our bikes this year are Honda Fireblades, the SP models, super bikes." And this guy said, "Well, you know, I don't understand why do you need a Fireblade? Why can't you just have a 600 or something?" And I said, "You're not thinking about the fact that it might be the second lap of the superbike race with Peter Hickman and Michael Dunlop, and you get a call to attend an incident, and that's it. You join the live race. You've got to move as quickly as you can and get to the incident as quickly as possible, and also try and do your best to keep out of everybody's way." But the other side to that coin is the competitors know that we're all past riders, so we know the correct racing line. We all know that, so we can stick to that. We may not be going as fast as them. The fact we're on the correct line means that if they want to pass us, they can do that safely.
And in terms then of how it works with you going around the course, do you have a sort of a set routine and told where to go? How does that all work?
That's one of the things that's changed over the time that I've been involved. We get something called an event safety plan now that Gary Thompson and his team produce, and that tells you absolutely to the minute where you need to be at for a start of a session and what your responsibilities will be once the roads close and where you go to. But then after that, of course, it just depends what happens, really.
And have you all got earpieces, presumably?
We've got radio mics. That's really, really useful. As you're riding along, you can get updates as to whether the helicopter's been called, what the condition of the rider is, if there's anything else you need to be aware of before you arrive at the incident. That's really, really helpful. And also as well, sometimes, let's think of an example, if the race or practice sessions is red flagged and you have a travelling marshal at the front and one at the back, you can talk to whoever's leading, so that works really well. Communication is... That's one of the biggest changes, I would say, in my experience as being travelling marshal.
It sounds like a real positive change.
Oh, yeah, huge. Oh, it's huge. Yeah, it used to be still a few legacy ones left around the course, the old green telephone boxes. It used to just stand next to a telephone box, and if there's an incident, you get a call. So if the incident, when you were reporting from an incident, I don't know, Balacob on the approach to Balaf, no phone box is there. And a number of occasions I had to go and knock on somebody's door and say, "Can I use your phone, please, to report and update on an incident?" That's how it was at the time. It all worked perfectly well. The other side to that was, because the communication wasn't so good, we used to get a lot more riding. And as travelling marshals, what you really want to do is ride your bike around the course. So we were pretty much riding, certainly in practice sessions, we were more often than not circulating the course. We don't get to do that so much anymore.
As we're talking, Jim, we're just under 6 weeks to the start of TT 2024. What is the next month and a half or so looking like for you? How does that play out as a travelling marshal?
Okay, so as a travelling marshal, this Saturday, 6 of us, I think, are going up to Jerby Airfield, and there's a track day on there, Gary Radcliffe. Gary's a hugely experienced TT rider, and he runs the race school up there. I think he runs the race school with Johnny Higginbotham. It's another example of where we're at the moment, and that we all have to pass a riding assessment. So we have to go up to Jerby Airfield and ride some laps of the course, and Gary follows us around and hopefully gives us a tick to say, okay, to carry on for another year. So we've got that to think about. We'll have some meetings at the hospital in regard to the immediate care, helmet removal and airway management and all that sort of, just a brush up on that type of thing. We'd normally get to meet Gareth and talk about loading people into the helicopter. That's really, really, really worthwhile, because sometimes the little tiny things like the mechanism for closing the helicopter door, for instance. I mean, that sounds really easy to do, but there are little locating pins on the helicopter door. And in the heat of the moment, it's not one of those things that you want to have to think about. It's a banana skin. But if you've practiced it, then you can feel confident about doing that part of it. So we'll have that meeting. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if Tony asked us for a get-together for another discussion before the event started.
And you've got the bikes you mentioned. Have you got those now, or do you get those a little bit nearer the time?
Actually, we're quite fortunate this year. They arrived probably 3 or 4 weeks ago. I came back to the island in between being in India and going to Japan for 3 days and got a bike and had to do 300 miles on it. I got my miles on it, and it's now gone down to AJR at Castletown, and Andy Grimshaw does the servicing on the bikes, fit the tyres and everything like that. So I'm just waiting for a call now to go and get my bike to get down to Castletown and do a few miles on it before my riding assessment with Gary on Saturday. So,
busy time. Yeah. Just thinking, I want to talk about some of the charity things that you do in a moment. But first of all, just still staying with the motorcycling theme, you were the first in your family to compete on the roads, but your boys have followed you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I look around now and I see lots of people sort of where I was maybe 20 years ago, and they've got their sons and daughters up doing schoolboy motocross, as I did. And I'm just thinking, be careful what you wish for, because before you know where they are, they'll be wanting to get out onto a racing bike. And so I've got two sons, Jack and Dewan, and they're both competing at Derby at the moment on the riding little Honda CB500s. But Jack rode in the Manx Grand Prix in 2014 and got a good finish in the newcomers race, and that put a whole different dimension to.
Were you travelling marshalling?
I was travelling marshalling
at the
same time, yeah.
Wow.
But I wasn't the first person to be in that position, because Dean Harrison, that's Nathan's dad, was in the same position with Glenn, and Paul Hunt was in the same position with Gavin. And I remember speaking to particularly Paul. Paul was superb, and he said, look, it doesn't make any difference, no point trying to put them off the idea, because that's not going to happen. He said, all you can do is get behind them and give them absolutely 100% support and help and assistance, whatever you can, to try and make sure they do it properly. So particularly coming from Paul, I don't know if you've ever met Paul, he's an awesome guy, and I thought, okay, that's it, that's the way to play it. It was a distraction. As you can imagine, you sort of, the race starts, and then you have to follow the race as you always would, and you're listening to what's going on. But you just can't help but look for, in my case, looking for Jack and seeing where he was, and so that was tough. And then of course Jack had a huge accident in 2017, like a humongous, not racing accident, a road accident. I can tell you the story if you want. It only takes a few moments, but it was I can tell you the date. It was March the 10th. 2017, it was a Friday, and I was at work in my classroom, and a knock on the door, and a secretary, a lady called Tracy Quayle, came in and said, oh, you need to come down the office, there's a police officer here for you. She said, yes, definitely for you. So I went down the office, there's a police officer there, and Jack was living in Kent at the time, and he said, your son's been involved in a road traffic accident. We're going to take you home, you can grab some belongings, we're going to take you to the airport, fly you to London City Airport. All I wanted to know, of course, is his condition. He can't say anything. But you can imagine, you're sort of building up a picture. The fact that they're come to pick me up, they put me on a flight. I'm thinking, this isn't going to pan out very well. I remember the flight, but what I remember more than anything is you get a flight to London City Airport, then you get on the underground, and you get off the underground at a tube station called Denmark Hill. I don't know if you've been there. You come out of the step at Denmark Hill, and then you can see King's College Hospital. And when I saw the hospital, it was like I was in some sort of parallel universe, and I just couldn't figure what was going on. And you know what you were saying about how do you deal with situations when it's tough? That was tough. I mean, Jack got through that, but it was he could easily have not got through it, because his blood pressure dropped really, really low. And then you see all these other guys like Dave Redmayne or Dave Masden-Migdal, who've lost their sons in racing accidents, and somehow or another they find the courage to carry on. It's awfully difficult, but it's so commendable as well at the same time.
And how is Jack now?
Yeah, he's I'm a granddad now.
Congratulations.
Yeah, he got married to Charlotte. Now I have a granddaughter who was born in November. That's Amelia. That's another new thing for us, so we're delighted about that. I don't think Jack will ever go road racing again. I think, like me, he'll always be a motorcyclist, and he loves riding his bikes. And I think the airfield thing is just riding at Derby, that's just the thing to sort of, he likes doing it, so, and it's comparatively safe up there.
And we've talked a lot about Derby and just how brilliant it is that we have that facility over here, and we're seeing some of the Manx talent going through there.
I mean, you look at the TT entry list and you see, gosh, and looking down it with Ryan and Jamie Kringle and Paul Cassidy, Dave Rigby, Marcus Simpson. I think he had a great weekend at Scarborough, and of course Joe and Nathan. It's just superb.
And I did mention some of the charity things you do.
Yes.
I don't honestly how do you find the time? Like, I mean, I suppose it's a little bit easier now that you've retired.
Well,
but
I don't do any DIY. Before I came here, I was actually trying to work out how to fit a fence in the back garden, but so that's sort of caught up with me over the last couple of months, and I've got to get myself back up to the hardware store and get some of that stuff done. But
tell us about the charity side of things. Where did this all start?
That all started with, if you're a road race fan in the 1980s, there's one guy that stands out absolutely head and shoulders above everybody else, and that's of course Joey Dunlop. The thing is with Joey, it's, I always loved Joey, but I went to Ireland to watch him the road races there, the Northwest 200 and Scariers, and that's when you really see how much the people loved him. It was like a Mexican wave around the course, people waving their programmes and everything. But then he went off and did this amazing humanitarian work as well when he went to Romania. I love the story about Joey Dunlop when the BBC said to him, come on Joey, we want to put a reporter with him, we'll take the reporter off. Absolutely no way, he's such a humble guy, so understated, no, nobody's coming with me. And then they said to him, okay, look, take a camera with you, record a few bits and pieces, which he agreed to do. And then when he got back, apparently, he gave him the camera back. It hadn't even been turned on. Completely not interested in that side of it. But because he was such a huge icon of Northern Ireland, for him, gathering the bits and pieces he wanted to take off to Romania, that wasn't a problem. But I absolutely loved Joey, and one of the greatest things for me riding around the course is I did get to ride part of the course with him in 1987. That meant a lot. But I always thought one of these days I'm going to try and follow in his footsteps, what he did. That sounds easy, but it's actually quite difficult to work out where he went because nobody recorded it. And I got in touch with a guy called John Harris, who used to provide Joby with 600 Hondas to ride in the production TT. John was really helpful, and he's, I can tell you bits and pieces. So I got a sort of feeling for where he went, because I just wanted to do exactly what he did. Initially, I was going to go with somebody called Kevin Quirk, who Kevin was a trustee of the Haywood Foundation, as I was. Huge Joey fan, and he was one of the principal organisers of the Joey Dunlop Foundation. But unfortunately, Kevin wasn't very well. So then Ian Pert, and Ian from Scotland, his son's riding the Grand Prix this year, Callum, he agreed to come, and Ronnie Russell, well-known local motorcyclist, prepared all the Wilson and Collins bikes, and fantastic Manx Grand Prix rider himself. He said he'd come along, so the three of us got some... Oh, that's right, yeah, that's the other really sad part of the story. We decided we was going to go, and then I mentioned Dave a few minutes ago, but sadly Dave's son, Billy Redmayne, was killed in an accident at Scarborough in 2016, so we decided we'd try and see if we could raise a bit of money for the Billy Redmayne Foundation, and went out to Romania and delivered a vanload of bits to the people out there that were having a hard time. And then after that, when I got back, I thought, well, that was great, but I'm not sure if Joey was doing this now, he probably wouldn't choose Romania to go to, because Romania wasn't, I mean, it was back in the time, you had that, what's the name, Annika Reis, and she was doing all that stuff, and Romania was it was the Ceausescu regime's coming to an end, and all the children's orphanages and all that, it was big news. In 2018 it was Syria, so we thought, let's try Syria. So we didn't actually go into Syria, but we went to the we got within 20 minutes of the Syrian border with the refugee camp, took loads of stuff. My favourite thing that we took, I've got to tell you about it briefly, Helen Withers, who's the chief sector marshal for Sector 2 on the TT course. I knew her dad, Arnie, because he used to play for Moran as well. But Helen was involved in Moran Football Club, and she gave me a set of Moran football shirts for their youngsters. I also know Howard Kelly, who is president of St John's Football Club, and he gave me a set of St John's shirts as well.
I can see where this is going.
So the camp is... I could talk for hours about the camp, but the one thing that sticks in my mind about it is people in the camp are saying, it feels to us like everybody's forgotten about us. They're living in these tents, and they've been there in 2018, I think, for about a year and a half, and nothing was happening for them, but they couldn't have made us more welcome. It was a really humbling moment, and I said, I've got a flag in my bag. Can I take the flag out and can you take a picture of it? He said, do not take the flag out. If you take the flag out, we're going to have a lot of trouble. So he said, give me the flag. When you've gone, I'll get the flag out and I'll get a photograph taken. So yeah, of course, yeah, okay. So I handed the flag over, the two bags of football kits. After we'd gone, he got the flag out because I didn't say to him, I've got an Isle of Man flag. So he assumed I'd got a Union Jack, which would have been a definite, don't get that out here. And he said, oh, if only you'd said, we could have... But anyway, he sent me this lovely photograph of two sets of teams lined up, one in the St John's, one in the Ryan FC kits, holding the three legs Isle of Man flag. Felt really proud of that. That was good. That was quite a moment. And then going back to the social media, these two young Syrian guys who got their flag, they didn't know which way round it should be. Obviously, they had it upside down, and quite a few people were having a go at me saying, oh, the flag's upside down. I'm in the van in the middle of here. I'm not there. It's like, somebody's always got to pick a little fly in something.
And yeah. More recently, you're talking about the places which are in the spotlight at the moment, but you've been to Ukraine as well.
Yeah, we went to, Ronnie and I went to Lesbos, somebody called Home for All, did some work there with in a refugee camp. Then Ronnie and I have been to, we went to the Ukraine border a couple of months after the war broke out. And then last year, we actually went in to Ukraine with a local guy called Chris Baker. Chris and Ruth do a lot of work. And we went in and we went to a school, a orphanage and some sheltered accommodation. And again, the motorcycling community in general is so generous, and we were able to supply medicines and all sorts of bits and pieces that they needed at three different places. We're hoping to go back. We want to go back later this year. Ronnie and myself hope to go back to Ukraine.
And it's incredible, yeah. Because you know, this isn't necessarily a very safe thing that you're doing.
It's relatively safe in the west of the country. We were southwest of Kyiv, and they have had air raids in the area. But the staff at the school, again, the head teacher, I'll try and think of the lady's name, what an unbelievable lady. In the face of such hardship, somehow or another finding the courage to carry on. Her husband was off training soldiers for the front line, so she hadn't seen her husband for ages. The staff at her school hadn't been paid for months. Huge difficulties with getting the students to come into school because of the fear of an air raid attack. They have air raid shelters in the school, everything. And again, everyone was just so... You walked into a classroom over there, unannounced, and all the children stood up and stood there, waiting for you to say, no, please sit down. It was just the sense of order and resilience, difficulty of their situation was... It just made you think, we've got to try and do more. We've got to go back. And what we actually provide, it doesn't really make it any difference. I appreciate that. It's such a tiny amount. But I think people just, in my experience now, people just like to think that they know what other people are thinking about them. That's the main thing, I think.
It makes you realise, I guess, just how lucky we are over here.
Yeah. And so you come back from the school in Ukraine and you go back to St Ninian's. And I'm not saying some of the things that people get het up about aren't important. They just seem quite trivial by comparison.
Well, keep us posted when you next go, Jim, because we'd like to sort of keep up to date with how that's going. And if anybody can contribe things, that would be
great. Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about the road races you're involved in Mexico.
Oh, in Mexico, yeah. That's
another story.
That's going to be getting dark soon. Well, that all came about. Dave Mazda-Migdal went out to Mexico in 2018. I didn't know that at the time, but then a guy called Hector Quintanilla, a Mexican guy, huge, huge TT fan, he started putting comments on some of my social media stuff. And the upshot of it was, I'll come and introduce myself when we're over for the TT. 2022, that was. That's right. And he did. He came up to the Hayward Centre and he tapped me on the shoulder and said, I'm Hector. And what was the name of the guy he was with? He was with another Mexican guy as well. And we sat down and had a chat. And Hector said, we want you to come to Mexico. And I thought, yeah, okay, fair enough. But then he said, look, go and speak to Dave about it and Dave will tell you. So I went to speak to Dave and said, this Mexican guy, he said, Dave said, yeah, I know Hector. Yeah, he said, if Hector said that, he means it. So the next thing I was asking school if I could have a bit of time off. That's a bit of a recurring theme, isn't it?
I wasn't going to mention it.
To go to Mexico, and that was my last year. I sort of decided at that point, okay, if the school say, sorry, you can't go, I thought, It's too good an opportunity to turn down. All I had to do was get to Ronald's Way. Everything else was sorted, and I got a bike to ride and Caine Road Race. And it's a 74-kilometre course. It runs through the Sinaloa Hills in Mexico. It's a tremendous event. And that particular, the first year I went, I went with Gary Johnson, who's won a couple of TTs, of course, and Matthew Rees, and just had just such a wonderful, fantastic time. It was just, they made us so welcome. And you know what you're saying about the guys down at the Southern? They put so much into it. Jorge Quintone, he came over for the event, and you kindly arranged for us to... for Jorge to say a few bits and pieces. It's like this common language of motorcycling. It doesn't matter which part of the world you go to, and it doesn't matter what you do for a living. There's no prejudice in it. It's just the common love of bikes that brings everybody together. And although I only speak a little minute amount of Spanish, didn't matter, because you had something in common with these guys, and it was just a tremendous event. It's a sort of a developing relationship now. When I say developing relationship, what they want to do is they want to have a Mexican rider competing on the mountain course. That's their side of it. But they're also very interested to hear any feedback you can give them on their event. So Gary and Matthew are very good about that, and I chipped in a few things about what they might do to progress. And when I went back this year, that's what I said to Jorge. I said, look at what you've done in 12 months. Look at this event now. You've improved all the aspects of the safety. You've got all these additional people involved who can provide assistance if something goes wrong. You've got the full authorisation and approval of the local tourist board. And so you just get the feeling that the event's really going places. But if you don't mind, I'll just say a little bit more about, we had two winners from the Manx Grand Prix. That's Joe Yeardsley and Victor Lopez, who won the junior and senior Manx Grand Prix. I didn't have so much of a role in getting Victor out there, but certainly Joe, I sort of paved the way for Joe to go out to Mexico. Maurizio Botolico was also there, and two French riders as well. So it's the amount of Europeans competing in the event is definitely increasing. Joe Yeardsley, gosh, what a talent that guy is. That guy is something else, because I was lucky enough to have the opportunity to ride behind Joe at the start of the week when we're doing the familiarisation runs. I remember Steve Colley, the trials rider, talking about Joe, because Joe did a lot of trials when he was younger, and Steve was saying he wasn't surprised that Joe won the Senior Max Grand Prix, because he's one of these guys, you can jump on a bike and he can ride it. And he came down the Caine course in 38 minutes. I know it's difficult to put that into perspective, but I can assure you that is really unbelievably fast. And he finished second overall, and he said he would have done better if it wasn't for the fact his back brake had stopped working. But I tell you, the sort of guy Joe is, that because he's very fortunate, he's got Robbie Black and Chris Palmer looking after him. They're a very close-knit little team, and they work really well together, and they really look after each other. So I think Joe's very fortunate there to have the benefit of Chris's experience. So they're looking at the bikes before the start, trying to decide who needs new tyres, and Joe looked at his side and said, I don't need new tyres. You know, it's not important, I don't need them. And everyone's a bit shocked, because normally bike racers are so fussy about the tyres they're using. As far as he's concerned, no, I don't need any new tyres. And then it came to tyre warmers. There were four bikes and three sets of tyre warmers. So somebody's going to have to deal with that tyre warmers. So Joe says, don't need them. And he spoke to Chris about it. He said, no, the temperatures, it's hot. We've got a straight before the first right-hander. We don't need tyre warmers. It's so out of the ordinary to hear bike racers talking like that. But that's just the sort of guy he is. And we had a wonderful time, and showed. I'm convinced Joe would have won if it wasn't for the brake issue. But then we got invited down to Mexico City so we went from Mazatlan, which is on the west coast of Mexico, down to Mexico City, back to our flight. And then there's this thing there called Moto Expo Show, and it takes place beneath the Mexican World Trade Center. It's a huge, huge show. And there's five enormous arenas. I would say each one is the size of the London Bike Show. It's absolutely enormous, this show. And when we turned up on the first day to queue to go in, it's like the press day, when we got there, there were two huge signs outside the door. One had Victor Lopez on, and one had Joe Yeardsley on. I was just thinking, that's the Manx Grand Prix at the front door of Moto Expo. And then we got in there and they had a big, huge show opening, a theatre, similar sort of size to the Villa Marina. Huge event. And then Joe gets called up onto the stage to be presented with something. And it's another one of Joe's strengths. He spoke so well. And but all in the background, it was Manx Grand Prix. And I was thinking, here we are, Moto Expo, Mexico City, Manx Grand Prix. And I thought, yeah, that's I felt quite proud about that. I'm not saying it wouldn't have happened without my involvement, but I certainly felt like I contributed towards getting it there. So they've got lots of plans. They're lovely, lovely guys, and I really value my friendship with them. I would class them as my friends now. Yeah, they're smashing guys.
So watch this space with regards to how that goes. Jim, so much more that we could talk about. Yeah. Just very briefly, you mentioned the Halewood Centre, which is something that you're involved in. For anybody who's not familiar with that, what happens there?
The cafe behind the grandstand, it's something that we're aware of. People think that for some reason that it's just a facility for the riders. It is a facility for the riders, but we're delighted to see the general public in there as well. Adrian Earnshaw and Kevin Quirk, and I think Jeff Duke was involved as well, and setting up the Halewood Foundation back in the, I'm going to say, late 70s, early 80s. The whole idea is that they support riders wanting to further their careers on the mountain course. I got involved in that principally through Adrian, because I was involved in the newcomer training program. So Adrian arranged for a sum of money to be paid to the Manx Grand Prix newcomers, and that was given out to the newcomers. Basically, the money that Adrian was giving out comes from the sale of teas and coffees and sandwiches at the Halewood Centre during TT Week and Manx Grand Prix Week. So it's a non-profit making organisation. Dave Ronan, Adam Klukas, Laura Sawyer and Monica Flooding are the other trustees. Between us, we sort of, not so much myself anymore, I hasten to add, that the other guys keep the cafe running, and they organise events at the cafe. For example, the Young Farmers use it for their tractor run, and people make a donation to the Halewood Foundation. There are people there that let office space in there, and that all the sales of everything, it all goes back into this big pot, and then that gets distributed to Manx Grand Prix newcomers. And you were saying about what's going to happen between now and TT Week. Well, the Halewood Foundation has got to look down the list of riders that it would like to support this year. TT newcomers, or people like Marcus or Joe or Dave Rigby, or not just Manx riders who are making that step from the Grand Prix to the TT. So if you want a sandwich and a drink TT Week, please come over and say hello. And you know absolutely full well that any small profit we might make on the sale of anything will go straight back into the riders' pockets.
Well, Jim, I wonder if there's time for you to go home and fix your fence before all of the other bits you've got to do. Is that very likely, do we think?
I think we should keep talking, actually. Save the fence for another day.
It's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for talking to us. Being such an integral part of racing, not only on the mountain course, but mentioned down the Southern 100 course as well. So many years on, hopefully many, many more years to go. But what does it mean to you?
To look out the window is, I said when I came, and what a beautiful view. To look out the window and see Kate's Cottage, Craigna Bar, the start line, that's it. That's where my heart is. And to have the opportunity, having finished my racing, to stay involved through my travelling marshal, and to be given the chance to be involved in the Manx Motor Soccer Club and work with amazing people like Ned Bowers and John McBride, the chairman, and the rest of the committee. It's such a pleasure, and it's a huge part of my life, and I hope it can carry on being a huge part of my life for many years to come.
Jim, we wish you all the best for TT 2024 and
you,
all the other racing as well.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you.
Travelling Marshal Jim Hunter, an absolutely fantastic chat with him. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I don't suppose that fence has been done yet, though. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Journey to a Dream, brought to you by Kawasaki Insurance. You can visit them, kawasaki-insurance.co.uk, to find out how you can get covered. And if you've got a story that you'd like to tell, please do get in touch. I'd love to hear from you. BethEsby@manxradio.com is the email address. And until next time, goodbye.